This is audible.
The work I did. A memoir of the secretary to Goebbels. Brunhilde Pomse, Tore D. Hansen. Recorded by Elke DeWitt at Pinewood Studios, 2018. The biographical part of this book is based on conversations with Brunhilde Pomse that were recorded in Munich for the film Ein deutsches Leben, A German Life. Is it a bad thing? Is it egoism if people try to do something in place where they have been put that is good for them and they know I won't be harming anyone else? But who does that? No one thinks so far ahead. We were short-sighted and indifferent. Brunhilde Pomse, Munich, 2013. The work I did is not only one of the most important contributions to the analysis of the Holocaust, but in view of the current political situation, a long overdue, timeless warning to present and future generations. Daniel Czarnock, Holocaust survivor. Foreword. Tore D. Hansen. As a shorthand typist and secretary to Joseph Goebbels, Brunhilde Pomse was close to one of the biggest criminals in history. Shortly after Adolf Hitler seized power, Pomse briefly joined the Nazi Party in order to get a job with Reichsrundfunk, the Reich Broadcasting Corporation. In 1942, she switched to Hitler's Ministry of Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda, finding herself mixing with the elite of National Socialism. In the last days of the war, when Soviet troops were already in the streets of Berlin, she was still typing out legal documents and even sewing the flag for the official capitulation of Berlin, rather than grabbing an opportunity to flee. She remained silent about her experiences for over 7 decades. In their documentary film, A German Life, the filmmakers Christian Krönes, Olaf S. Müller, Roland Schrotthofer, and Florian Weigensamer put Brunhilde Pomse in front of the camera and allowed her, in impressively lit black and white pictures, to tell stories from her life. Her narrative is both disconcerting and fascinating. This book is based on the memories she recorded in 2013. They were arranged chronologically by the author and carefully corrected where spoken language and grammar required it. Brunhilde Pomse's account begins with her childhood in Berlin, where she was born in 1911. It covers the outbreak of the First World War and life with her laconic father, who returned uninjured from Russia in 1918, as well as the strict upbringing that she received as the elder sister of 4 brothers, and which had a lasting effect on her. Her father was an uncommunicative man, and politics wasn't discussed at home. She grew up in one of the more affluent parts of Berlin, and the family could feed itself comparatively well, while in the rest of Berlin, as in Germany generally, wide sections of the population were suffering. The country was subject to unrest. The politically extreme opposites, communists and national socialists, protested on the streets, and there were increasingly violent clashes. But in the Berlin district of Südende, a part of the city with numerous villas, there was little sense of the conflict. In retrospect, Pomse's indifference towards the new Nazi Party strikes her as crucial for her career. Heinz, her summer romance, introduced her to a decorated officer from the First World War. That meeting was to be fateful for the young woman. The officer in question was Wolf Blei, later a radio reporter and early party member, who took her under his wing. The man who, as a reporter, would use overblown language to describe the torchlight procession after the victory of the Nazi Party in March 1933. Shortly after Hitler came to power, he took Brunhilde to the Deutsches Theater, where Blei, the author Monke, was failing as a dramatist. In the end, as member of the Nazi Party, he was offered a job with the Reichsrundfunk and told Pomse to join the party so that she could be his secretary. The corporation had been cleansed by the Nazis long before, and all the Jewish directors had been dismissed and banned from employment. Only a short time later, Wolf Blei was moved again, but for Brunhilde the meeting with him was the start of a social ascent that would take her to the inner circle of power, the beginning of an extraordinary era. While she has lost many memories in the intervening 70 years, central events and turning points remain vivid in her mind. the details and the way she deals with her experiences in the Reichsrundfunk and later in the Ministry of Propaganda are not free from considerable contradictions. Again and again we come upon passages where she withholds something, only to admit it elsewhere, and this makes her narrative fascinating. Brunhilde Pomser's story does not give us fresh historical perspectives, but it gives us insights into what it was like for a person caught up in those times, and so warns all of us in our own time. It is almost indisputable that now, as then, we find ourselves in a political situation where anti-democratic tendencies and right-wing populism are gaining ground again. Political and sociological analysis have been actively engaging with the question of how it can be that it is socially acceptable in Europe and the United States to express right-wing ideas, to scapegoat whole groups, and tolerate attacks on minorities such as war refugees. Brunhilde Pomser wasn't interested in politics. Her job came first, along with her material security, her feeling of duty towards her superiors, and the need to belong. She describes her career vividly and intimately. She denies any personal responsibility for the crimes of the National Socialist system. But after the premieres of the film A German Life in Israel and San Francisco, there were very few scornful voices or attributions of blame. Hats off to anyone who could confidently claim he wouldn't have joined in, as the correspondent of the Frankfurter Rundschau put it. Rather than provoking a condemnation of Pomser's life, the documentary prompted questions about our time. Are the dark 1930s being repeated? Are our fear, ignorance, and passivity in the end responsible for the strengthening of the new right? For a few decades, we assumed that the ghost of fascism had been exorcised. But Pomser makes clear to us that this isn't so. In the film, her amazingly clear accounts of her harmless everyday life in the middle of wartime, her rise as an apolitical girl, and her emotional detachment from reality are mutely juxtaposed with Goebbels' quotations, mountains of corpses, and the skeletal figures of Jews who were sent to the concentration camps. The comparisons with the present day inspired me to juxtapose Pomser's experiences with recent developments and make them my theme. Are fears that history might repeat itself exaggerated? Or did we reach a point long ago where a new era of fascism or authoritarianism can no longer be prevented? Can Pomser's story give us clues about the extent to which seeking personal advantage allows us to be ignorant about social and political developments? The challenges of the modern age in the form of digitalization, financial crises, wars, waves of refugees, climate change, the social parameters of a networked world and the resulting fears of decline and rising immigration have led to many people withdrawing into the private sphere. 70 years ago, Brunhilde Pomser lived in a time completely different from our own. She tells us of her small decisions, which at first strike the listener as logical, reasonable, and understandable, to the point where every individual can wonder, might I too not suddenly have found myself sitting in Goebbels' outer office? How much of Pomser is there in each of us? Or, as one editor asked provocatively after the premiere of the film, are we not all Pomser to some extent? And millions of Pomsers who only think of their own advancement and material security, and at the same time put up with injustice in society and discrimination against others, are a solid basis for every manipulative, authoritarian system. And this makes them more dangerous than the radical hardcore of voters for extremist parties. In the end, Brunhilde Pomser had to watch her country drag an entire continent into the abyss. Engagement with the parallels between past and present allows us to adjust our own moral compass so finely that we notice when we have reached the point where we need to take a position, stand up and confront things clearly and openly. How casually do we treat our inner moral measuring instrument? For what primitive, short-term, banal, and superficial goals or apparent successes do we sacrifice this inner standard? These are questions to which the story of Brunhilde Pomser cannot and will not provide any universal answers. Only individual willingness to reflect can do this. In many European countries, populists are on the rise. The leaders of some European countries, such as Poland and Hungary, are already dismantling democratic systems. Not to mention Turkey, where the principles of constitutional state and freedom of opinion have already lost their validity, and where mass arrests and purges of supposed critics have become the mechanisms of an emerging dictatorship. And it might not be the last. And then there is the phenomenon of Donald Trump in the United States, with the dirtiest election campaign in US history against minorities and migrants, as well as against the establishment. An election campaign waged with lies and racist slogans, which enabled the property mogul to reach the office of president. By mobilizing voters with slogans and simplistic solutions to a highly complex world, Trump became the 45th president of the United States. Yet over 40% of the US population did not even vote. Are these the harbingers of a new age of authoritarianism that threatens the very foundations of freedom and democracy? Against this background, Brunhilde Pomsel's story serves to confront the reader with the urgent issue of our own responsibility for contemporary events, as a warning to stop looking away. On the pages that follow, Brunhilde Pomsel tells us of her childhood, her work to the end of the war, her subsequent internment in a Soviet special camp, and her return to freedom. Also running through her biography is the fate of her Jewish friend Eva Löwenthal, who at first was able to keep her head above water in Berlin as a journalist, but was finally deported in 1943 to Auschwitz concentration camp, where she was murdered. Pomsel's story reveals a lack of interest in politics among the population, along with a loss of empathy and solidarity. One of the causes for the rise and success of the National Socialists, even if she herself does not or cannot see this in a way free of contradictions. She allows us a glimpse into ourselves and reminds us of the words of the Polish author Andrzej Staszczuk. The more afraid we voters are, the bigger the cowards we elect. And these administrators of fear then sacrifice everything to remain in power. Us, our country, our continent of Europe. Tore D. Hansen, January 2017. Before 1933, nobody thought about the Jews anyway. It was all invented by the Nazis later on. It was only National Socialism that made us aware that they were different people. Later, that was all part of the planned program for the extermination of the Jews. We had nothing against Jews. Brunhilde Pomsel. We weren't interested in politics. Growing up in 1930s Berlin. Brunhilde Pomsel's memories begin vaguely with the outbreak of the First World War in August 1914, when she is 3 years old. Her mother receives an unexpected telegram and her father is one of the first to be called up for military service. They take a fast coach to Potsdamer Bahnhof to say goodbye to him. After 4 years of war, Brunhilde's father comes home unharmed in November 1918. My memories are very important to me, and they pursue me too. They won't let go of me. I may forget names and certain events that I can't describe in words, but otherwise everything is there as if in a big encyclopedia or a picture book. I think back to when I was a little girl, and I know that in my life I have given a lot of people joy by my very existence. That's a lovely thought too. When my father came back from the war, I very clearly remember us asking our mother, Mutti, what's that strange man doing in our flat? And then a difficult time began. We were living from hand to mouth in those days. Towards the end of the First World War, soup kitchens were set up. Even though my mother always cooked and prepared everything for us, at one point she said, let's try them out. And she took us children to one of those soup kitchens, and we had lunch. And when we left, she said, I am never doing that again. On the way home, I told my mother, I'd like to bang in a nail for Hindenburg. There was a huge wooden figure in Königsplatz, a crude depiction of Field Marshal Hindenburg. And for 5 pfennigs, a sechser, Berliners call a 5-pfennig piece a sechser, They handed you a hammer and a nail, and you were allowed to knock the nail in somewhere at a particular spot. That was, you had to do that. She donated the money to make me happy. My father had been lucky. He was in Russia, always in Russia, and yet he wasn't injured, let alone killed. But the war had marked him in a different way. He had become an even quieter man than before. And perhaps that was why politics was never discussed at home. Until the Nazis came, and then it was, but even then, only superficially. Things weren't easy for big families in those days. There were five of us children, and they wanted to have another girl, but they got only boys. Such matters were out of your control in those days, so it was all left up to chance. As the oldest and the only girl, I was a bit overstretched. I was responsible for everything the boys did. It was always, you should have kept an eye on them. By my standards today, children back then weren't brought up well enough. Children were there, and they were looked after, and they ate their fill, and to a certain extent they were given toys, a ball or a doll, but no more than that. We had to ask for everything, and were brought up very strictly. We were smacked every now and again. We were a really normal German family. So, as the oldest, I carried certain burdens around with me. And even when you grow up a bit later on and had some wishes or notions, there were always a bit of malice in the response, along the lines of, yes, yes, you ask for so much. You weren't taken very seriously. We lived very modestly. But we always had enough to eat. I can't remember being hungry or anything like that, and that wasn't something you could take for granted when there were armies of poor and unemployed people. Our father ruled over everything, and we asked him for a lot of things, but we often tried in vain to get out of Mama, but she wouldn't fall for it. Mostly she said, "Ask Papa!" Later, he became a good friend. But when we were little, we had to do as we were told. We learned what we were allowed to do and what we weren't. And we were punished for doing things we were not allowed to do. There were many such things. For example, every now and again, precious apples were bought. Then they lay in a fruit bowl on the sideboard and everybody knew how many there were. Suddenly, an apple went missing. Who was it who took the apple? Nobody? Everybody come here. You? You? Everyone was questioned individually, but not me. Right. If it wasn't anybody, there will be no more apples anymore. Then you would say, I saw Gerhard playing around with the fruit bowl. So the children were played off against each other. Or again, my mother had the habit of putting small change in a cup in the kitchen cupboard. It was very tempting to reach in and take out a 10 or 20 pfennig coin. Someone did that once and gave himself away by suddenly running about with a huge stick of rock. Children are very stupid. These things were punished to set an example. And then we got a smack on the backside with the carpet beater. That hurt, I can tell you. And after that, there was peace in the family again. My father was happy that he had done his duty, and we children didn't think it was so bad that we wouldn't consider doing it again. Obedience became a part of family life. Love and understanding didn't get you very far. Obedience and a bit of cheating, fibbing, or shifting the blame onto someone else were also involved. So, characteristics were brought out in the children that weren't necessarily part of their nature. Love wasn't the only prevailing emotion among the many people living together in a flat. We all got what was coming to us. That was perhaps less true for me as a girl, but I often heard, as the biggest one, you should have known. So I was forever having disappointment rubbed in my face. I was always responsible for everything the boys got up to. When we were 10 or 11 years old, we always wanted to know how our parents had voted. They never told us. Even today, I don't know why. It was a secret. Politics wasn't something we talked about at home. We weren't interested in it. My father was quite secretive anyway, but not least about his youth. He too came from a big family. And much later, long after his death, I learned that his father had taken his life. And that my father had grown up in Dresden with his brothers and his only sister in an orphanage. I found that out by chance only about 40 years ago. My mother was still alive at the time. I asked my mother, Mama, didn't you know? And she said, yes. And I asked her, and why didn't you tell us? Papa didn't want me to. Papa didn't want her to, so she didn't. His father had been a court gardener at the Saxon royal court. He even had a title. He bred a strawberry and got a diploma for it and also a considerable sum of money. Anyway, he went on to speculate on the Amsterdam flower market and lost all of his property, a very nice house with a garden, and then abandoned his wife and 5 children by jumping off a bridge in front of a train in Dresden. A tragedy that troubled my father a lot. We weren't supposed to know about it, but I learned of it from a cousin many, many years later. I remember constantly hearing that we had no money. Papa was a decorator and had a job, and that in itself was a luxury in those days, so we always had enough. We almost never went hungry, unlike so many other people after we lost the First World War. There was always something to eat. It was simple and plain, but it filled you up, a lot of vegetables. My mother made wonderful vegetable stews. I sometimes long for them even today, whether it was Savoy cabbage or white cabbage with caraway or green beans with tomatoes. It was a real luxury. And we still had enough for a goose at Christmas, which we just had to have. And Papa had to have his little glass of beer too, and Mama always got something nice to wear for Easter. When I was about 14, my friends were getting suits or coats. I wasn't. I got hand-me-downs, which were altered for me. They were made to fit, and I wasn't exactly spoiled. I knew we didn't have very much money, and if you got something, everyone else would want it as well. That was the principle. They were always talking about how there wasn't any money, but we could always pay our rent. And when I'd finished compulsory education and the teacher said, the child absolutely has to go to a higher school, she's gifted, money was spent on that as well. So my mother got money out of my father for middle school, and I stayed there for a year. Then that was the end of middle school. If you wanted to do the Abitur, you had to go to the Lyceum. That was out of the question. Studying? Who studied 90 years ago? Only a very select group, not us anyway. When I was still at school, I wanted to be an opera singer or a teacher. I was such a good pupil that a rich lady asked my mother, Frau Pomsel, couldn't your daughter do her homework at our house with my Ilse? I can't do it, and she's not making any progress. She needs support. Ilse was a friend of mine, and I was happy to do it. We did our homework together, which isn't to say that I let her copy from me. I really helped her and explained things to her. She made considerable improvement just because I was patient with her and liked going there. They were a very wealthy family. I always got a cup of coffee or tea straight away, and of course there were cakes as well. And the mother was an Italian, a former opera singer. They also had a wonderful piano, and she always sang. She sang us opera arias, and we sat there entranced and listened. It was a lovely time, and it was better for me too, because it was always noisy and busy in our flat. I could never do my homework in peace, and I wanted to become an opera singer, but there wasn't enough money for that. And then, at our middle school, you could also attend a housekeeping school, but my father said, that's enough. I'm not paying for that as well. She'll learn housekeeping at home, not at school. School's over. So after my first year exams, I left middle school. At first, I stayed with my mother as an assistant housekeeper. But that didn't work. It was terrible. I couldn't stand working in the kitchen, and Mama was relieved to send me off around the flat dusting, because I got everything wrong in the kitchen anyway, so it was all a terrible disappointment. My mother always wanted me to do a proper apprenticeship, but at the time I just wanted to work in an office. It didn't matter where. It just had to be an office. For me, the ladies who worked in offices, secretaries, office managers, or business representatives with an insurance company were very attractive, and that struck me as something definitely worth striving for. And then I found myself a job in the Berliner Morgenpost, which already existed back then. Hard-working young female volunteer wanted for 2 years. I took a closer look. Hausvogteiplatz, that was a very smart area at the time. I knew that was where the upper class of the country lived, a posh area. I was to present myself at 1 o'clock. I immediately got on the train and traveled to the firm of Kurt Glesinger & Co., which was on Mohrenstraße. It was all very elegant. An amazing house with red carpets and a lift. I went up the stairs, which had soft carpets. I stepped inside a very beautiful big office, and there sat Herr Bernblum, a Jewish confidential clerk, severe, but a real personality. And there were 3 or 4 ladies sitting there. One of them was reaching the end of her contract. He gave me a good going over. He asked this and that, and suddenly he said, yes, fine. Here's your volunteer's contract. I just need one of your parents to sign it, since you're still underage. Can you come back with your father or your mother? I went home in great excitement and told my family straight away. I got a terrible telling off at first. The impudence of it, without asking, and who paid your fare? But then Mama came with me and signed a 2-year contract for the princely volunteer income of 25 marks a month. Then I did everything that needed to be done at Kurt Glasinger & Co., shorthand, typing, and in the evening I took courses at business school and learned the basics of bookkeeping. But at Glasinger's, they didn't need my knowledge of shorthand, which would later enable me to get into broadcasting and the Ministry of Propaganda. Even before my internship, I was brilliant at shorthand. I was always first to finish, only because at school I was in love with my teacher, but he wasn't in love with me. I worked there for 2 years. The best bit was always the journey to work. I took the suburban train from Südende to Potsdamer Ringbahnhof. Then I had to walk to Leipziger Platz. That was always a half-hour walk. And if I went via Leipziger Straße rather than Mohrenstraße, I passed by lots of lovely shops. Wonderful fashion shops with unattainably beautiful things. But it was always lovely to see the clothes and dream. And the business, the daily work itself, was good fun as well. I learned everything properly, like a good girl, and probably made quite a good job of it. By the end, I was even allowed to go on telephone duty. We had even had a telephone at home for some time, strictly forbidden to us children. We weren't allowed near it. Who would we have called? We had no idea who you would have called. Who had a telephone in those days? Now, Herr Bernblum said to me, Fräulein Pommesel, put me through to Schulze and Menge. Then, as he watched, I had to find the number, my hands shaking, and then they would answer, Südring Exchange, and then I would say, please put me through to the Nordring Exchange, and then someone else would answer, which number? Then I would say the number, and eventually the company would answer, and then I had to say, I would like to speak to Herr so-and-so for Herr so-and-so. That was difficult for someone who had never done anything like that before. You can hardly imagine. These days it's hard for me to cope with a mobile phone. But I was very industrious back then. I always was. It stayed in me. That very Prussian thing, that sense of duty. And a bit of self-subordination. It started in the family. You had to fit in or else it wouldn't have worked. In those days there was always an element of strictness to everything. It meant you had to ask for everything. And you had no money at your disposal. There was no pocket money back then. Like there is today when children get pocket money from their parents from a certain age. We did get something. Well, I only got something because I had done the washing up at midday every day for the whole family. That wasn't so easy in those days, not like just turning on the tap and rinsing the dishes. I had to heat up heavy pans. Then we had 2 basins, one in which you did the washing up with soda, and a rinsing basin, then a drainer. It involved a lot of work. And I also got pocket money for that. I even think it was 2 marks a month. That was why the transition to internship at my first money was very important to me. I stayed with Herr Bernblum for 2 years. After that, they asked me to stay for 90 marks a month. I had to discuss that with my parents because I wasn't yet 21. And my father said, 90? No, that's not enough. You must ask for 100. And the next day I told Herr Bernblum my father insisted on 100. I'm sorry then. We'll have to fire you. And then they fired me. My father said, quite right, find something else. So I went to the labor exchange for the first time, registered as unemployed, and was given a list of addresses where I was to go and present myself. For a short time, I ended up in a bookshop. I absolutely loved reading. I hadn't yet read very much, but reading was absolutely lovely, and they also paid the 100 marks without objection. It was that bitter cold winter of 1929, and by then I was 18 years old. But it was a terrible job. They didn't turn the heating on until very late, and the staff were cliquish and very unfriendly. I was desperately unhappy there. But then my father met a neighbor of ours in the street, Herr Dr. Hugo Goldberg, a Jewish insurance agent, and he talked to my father. How are you? How's business? What are the children up to? And eventually my father said, Hilde's grown up, and she's working already. So, what's she doing? Then Herr Goldberg said, you know what? My secretary is about to get married, so she'll have to stop working anyway. Send your daughter along to me. She always was a very clever girl. So the next day, I went to see Herr Dr. Goldberg at his house and introduced myself to him. I'd never seen him before, and I greeted him with a curtsy and everything. And then he says, let's give it a go. The world of insurance is very interesting. You can't know everything, but you learn a lot. And then I started working for him in the middle of 1929. After that came a calm and lovely time. For the first 2 years, they often had parties at Herr Goldberg's. They were all people with a lot of money. He lived on a huge floor of the villa. I remember a party for his wife's 50th birthday. It was all supposed to happen against a medieval backdrop, and he had bought everything he needed for it. He used my father for the construction of the stalls. He helped him a lot. And when it was all finished, he said to my father, we could use your daughter here as an orphan boy. I knew lots of his friends and acquaintances from the telephone. When my father asked me, I immediately said yes. So I showed up as an orphan boy. The guests were all Jewish friends. Dr. Goldberg was always having these fantastic ideas. Anyway, the party started in the late afternoon and lasted all night, and I was there until the morning. I had short trousers on and a little jacket with a feather on it, and I had my boots over my shoulder. It was wonderful. Over time, I learned a lot about the insurance business there. There was always a lot of dodgy dealing going on, but still there was a lot of money left over, except not for me. I was getting 90 marks there again. That was the usual price for office girls at the time. But over the 4 years that I was there, in my last year, 1932, I went up to 120 marks. Then, just before 1933, Dr. Goldberg cut my working time by half, as his business wasn't going so well. By then, I had the feeling that he would soon be closing up his office and his flat in Germany. From then on, I was only there from 8 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon, and he had no money left and was very poor. At the time, I had a boyfriend, Heinz, a student from Heidelberg. Not a great passion, but he was my first boyfriend. My girlfriends all had boyfriends already, who they would meet up with, and I didn't have one. We all went to a tea dance, and they had brought him along, and we were paired off. He had hardly any money because his father kept him very short of funds because he didn't want him to study but to take over the firm. And I had nothing either. Of the little that I had, I handed some over at home, even if it was only 5 marks. So there was very little left for me, and when I met Heinz, we actually only went walking. He didn't take me to the cinema because he would have had to pay, and I couldn't have taken him out because it wasn't done in those days. When we went for a coffee, he had to pay. That was how it was. I would have insulted him if I'd said no. And anyway, it wouldn't have occurred to me. When you went for a meal or a cup of coffee or whatever with a man, he had to pay. It didn't matter what he did or got in return. Crazy. All the rules in those days that you just unquestioningly obeyed. Then, and this was still before 1933, my boyfriend Heinz had 2 tickets for the Sportpalast, which was always an event in Berlin. Boxing matches and then those wonderful skating displays that were typical of the Sportpalast. So I went with him. I was looking forward to it because I didn't know what to expect. He was waiting for me with a crowd of foul-smelling men who were all sitting on benches and waiting for something. And he waited too. Suddenly there was music, a band which played an exciting march. That was all very nice too. And then came a fat man in uniform, Hermann Göring. He delivered a speech that didn't interest me at all. Politics. And why would it have done? I was a woman, and I didn't need it. Afterwards, I just said to Heinz, never make me go to anything like that again. It was incredibly boring. Then he said confidently, I thought the same. He didn't even try to persuade me that a party had been set up that would free Germany of the Jews, nothing like that. Before 1933, nobody thought about the Jews anyway. It was all invented by the Nazis later on. It was only National Socialism that made us aware that they were different people. Later, that was all part of the planned program for the extermination of the Jews. We had nothing against Jews. On the contrary, my father was very glad to have some Jewish customers because they had the most money and always paid well. We played with the children of the Jews. There was one girl, Hilde. She was nice. And next door I remember a Jewish child my age, and I played with him sometimes. And then there was Rosa Lehmann Oppenheimer, with her little soap business. I remember her, too. So it never occurred to us that there was anything wrong with them. When we were growing up, nothing at all. And when National Socialism came closer and closer, we still didn't understand what might come. And we've waved at our beloved Führer, and why not? First, people wanted work and money. We had lost everything in the war, and the Versailles Treaty defrauded us, we were later taught. None of us had any idea what was coming our way with Hitler. Brunhilde Pomsel carries on with her carefree life, not guessing that she will soon take a job in the center of power of the National Socialist dictatorship, which will change her life forever. For my friend Heinz, I was too stupid for politics, too immature, but there was no reason for us to fight about it. I just had somebody I could meet on Sundays. We would go somewhere on the S-Bahn, take a stroll, have a coffee, and afterwards go to his flat. It was very nice that we were able to be alone at last. Afterwards, I often went to see my friends. Yes, I had friends. The boys were each more handsome than the next. One had a motorbike, and riding out of Berlin on the motorbike into the surrounding area, that was an experience. It was all very harmless. But among themselves, the boys were sometimes political, and we girls weren't interested. We didn't even listen. There was one who was a member of the KPD, the German Communist Party. He was still handsome. We liked him anyway. The others were certainly all Nazis or German nationalists. Sometimes I think, should I reproach myself for not having been interested in politics in those days? On the contrary, perhaps it was a good thing. Perhaps in youthful idealism you might even have found yourself on one side rather than another, and then you could have even been killed. In those days I was easily influenced, but I had a different circle of friends. They weren't all Nazis by any means. They were rich people's sons, slumming it a little. None of them had jobs. They were about to go to university or not. Their parents could afford it at least. Most of them were big business people. They had their villas in Berlin Südende. Their sons were between about 20 and 23, and none of them had thought about taking a job back then, or at least not so quickly. They were just bumming around, really. They were my friends, handsome boys, nice boys that you would have been pleased to meet. There were always these lovely occasions, parties, student parties. All the gymnasium had some kind of anniversary party every year. They were often held in the Park Restaurant in Südende. That was a wonderful meeting place for things like that in Berlin, by a lake with a bit of a forest around it and rowing boats or dinghies. In the winter, it was usually covered with ice, and then they turned it into a skating rink. And they had this wonderful giant restaurant and a lovely party house for big dances and smaller events. And even if you barely had any money for a beer, 20 pfennigs was enough, and then we drank together. The main thing was that we were sitting together in a pub. None of those young people was interested in politics, not one. But of course, there wasn't a single Jew in the clique. Only my Jewish friend Eva Löwenthal, she was often there. Politics was largely uninteresting as far as we were concerned. When I see what schoolgirls get up today expressing their opinions and everything, I think to myself, my God, that's a difference. That's an incredible difference. Then I sometimes think, I'm not over 100 years old, I'm 300 years old. Their whole way of life is completely different. In late 1932, Brunhilde Pomsel meets the future radio announcer Wolf Blei. It is a crucial meeting that, after Adolf Hitler's seizure of power, will smooth her path into broadcasting and later into Joseph Goebbels' Ministry of Propaganda. The author and radio announcer Wolf Blei, born 1890 in Berlin, died 1961 in Darmstadt, joined the NSDAP, Nazi Party, and the Sturmabteilung, SA, the paramilitary arm of the Nazi Party, in 1931. Blei was known to posterity chiefly for his observations about Hitler's seizure of power, when on the evening of 30th January 1933 he commentated on the torch-lit procession of the National Socialists through the Brandenburg Gate and later on parts of the 1936 Olympic Games. Anyway, my boyfriend Heinz had an acquaintance, a Reiter, a flight lieutenant from the First World War. Heinz knew that I was going to have to halve my hours of work for the Jew Dr. Goldberg. Heinz's acquaintance wanted to write his memoirs and needed someone to type them up for him, and Heinz suggested that I write to him. And that was Wolf Blei, a very nice, friendly man who didn't live far away from us. He had a terribly nice wife and a nice son. When I turned up, there was coffee and a bit of chat. And then I put his thoughts down on paper, and it went on like that. Herr Bligh had a friend, Captain Bush. He lived in Berlin-Lichterfelde. He wanted to write his memoirs as well, and could I perhaps help? He was very generous, so I went there every day and worked until dinner time. Then one of his sons would drive me home. They had a lot of money, and he almost made me rich. And so at the end of 1932, I was working for the Jewish Dr. Goldbach in the morning, and on some afternoons for the Nazi Wolf Bligh. I was sometimes asked if I didn't think it was a bit reckless working for a Nazi and a Jew. No. At the time, I was at least one of the ones who still had a job. There were huge numbers of unemployed in those days. Almost all my friends were unemployed. And I had been with Dr. Goldbach for 4 years. That was lovely. That was before 1933. But then, all at once, everything changed. It was all a bit ambivalent, but I didn't feel it was all that serious. I was completely uninterested in those things. At the time, I was a young girl in love. That was what mattered to me, and it's all so long ago. I can't see things from that perspective anymore. That's simply how it was in those days. You just slipped into it.
Brunhilde Pomsel.
Hitler was simply just a new man, joining the Reichsrundfunk. At the end of 1932, Brunhilde Pomsel is 21 years old, and under the laws of the time, she had reached maturity. Berlin was a vibrant and open city and had a lot to offer. Of course, that was only for people who had money. For the rich Jews, for the people who had money, there was a lot in Berlin. It was a city that had everything. It had things that people considered important at the time. Theater, concerts, a wonderful zoo. There's also lovely big cinemas, too. There was always a film. Then there was a film about culture as a B-feature and a stage show, often a solo singer, and a man at the piano, or a dance review, the Tiller Girls. There were lots of things like that, everything people needed. What else could you want? There were very smart restaurants, expensive restaurants, and of course, model feet never stepped inside them. I only found out a bit about that when I started at the radio station. But while Berlin might have been praised to the skies, it always had its dark sides, and particularly then, after losing the First World War. Unemployed people on every corner, beggars, poor people, anyone who lived in good areas as I did in a good suburb didn't see any of that. Of course there were particular areas swarming with poverty and wretchedness. You didn't want to see things like that. You just looked away. Then in March 1933, the Nazis suddenly won the elections. I don't know how my parents voted. I can barely remember how I voted. German National Party, I think. The colors were black, white, and red. I always quite liked that as a flag. Even in childhood, election Sundays were different from normal Sundays. There was an atmosphere with flags and posters and life all over Berlin. Election days were really fantastic. But it was about politics, so we young people weren't involved with it at all. And we weren't influenced. A short time before, in January 1933, my boyfriend Heinz dragged me along to Potsdam, where Hindenburg, an old man by then, and Hitler shook hands. I didn't even ask what that nonsense was all about. I didn't even want to know. And he noticed how stupid I was, how uninterested in politics. I certainly wasn't worthy of him. And he didn't try to convert me either. The party wasn't an issue between us at all, and within the year we split up anyway. When Hitler was appointed chancellor in January, the whole of Berlin was on its feet. The really mad ones made the pilgrimage to the Brandenburg Gate, and of course my boyfriend Heinz made the pilgrimage too, with me. All I remember is Hitler standing at the window of the chancellery. People, people, people everywhere, roaring as they would at a football match these days. We roared along. And when you'd roared and cheered enough, the others jostled you out of the way, and then you were delighted to have witnessed a historical event. I was one of the ones who cheered. It's true, and I admit it. Hitler was simply just a new man. But I certainly wasn't enthusiastic. I could never get enthusiastic about that. Later, I tried to avoid gatherings like that, if at all possible. I mostly managed to do that. I remember later, when I started working at the Reich Broadcasting Corporation, we always had to march to the Reich Sportsfield or to Tempelhof Airport when Mussolini came and so on. Then we had to put in an appearance. There were certain people in the departments that you didn't really trust.
who whispered things to somebody or other if you didn't join in. They kept a close eye on who didn't come, but we weren't stupid either. We went along nicely and marched along a little way. Then, when the big march began, I remember one time it was a march to the Reichssportsfeld. We had to meet in front of the broadcasting building. But our department had arranged to meet in a pub. Every 5 minutes or so, one of us crept away from the march and went to drink a beer instead. Of 20 people, only 2 ever showed their faces on the Sportsfeld. But that was always a small risk. There were certain departments that were kept under particularly close surveillance. For example, the literature department of the Broadcasting Corporation. But immediately after Hitler's accession, the mood was simply one of new hope. It was still a huge surprise that Hitler had done it. I think they were surprised themselves. But I was so uninterested at the time. For me, life just went on. I was still working for Dr. Goldbeck as well. Of course, I hadn't told him that I had cheered Hitler on 30th January. I didn't do that. I was still tactful enough not to do that to the poor Jew. Such things weren't done. It was all a bit ambivalent. But I didn't feel it was all that serious. I was completely uninterested in those things. At the time, I was a young girl in love. That was what mattered to me. And it's all so long ago. I can't see things from that perspective anymore. That's simply how it was in those days. You just slipped into it. We weren't all that aware of the Nazis' parades and torchlight processions either. Südende was the rather smarter part of Steglitz. We didn't know anything about the uprisings either in the 1920s or later, when things got going with Hitler. Everything was very nice and middle class. You found those things more in the parts of the city where the workers lived. Berlin Südende, where I lived, was a very smart part of town, and a few very well-off people lived there. There were a few very lovely villas and big houses where whole floors were rented out, and there were the shops and business people you would have expected. And there was a certain harmony there. I don't think I saw a single procession in Südende. They just didn't have things like that. And no one would have taken part. Certainly not there. And we didn't go to other places. There were a lot of things in the paper, but it was all very peaceful where we were. We had a certain flair. Those riots were on the main street, on Steglitzer Straße. And then there were Nazi processions. You got out pretty quickly. In fact, it barely touched us. The fact that my brothers joined the Jungvolk and wore those brown shirts, well, that was just how it was. And then more and more SA were running around in the streets. They didn't bother us, though. We didn't give them so much as a thought. And there was also a Nazi Women's League, although I was terrified that they would introduce a law that said we all had to join. There were rules about what you had to wear. BDM, Bund Deutscher Mädel, they had to wear blue pleated skirts. My whole circle thought they were dreadful. We wore tight skirts at the time. That was the fashion. And they were running about in this strange kind of clothes. That was really what worried me at the time. I managed to get out of joining the Nazi Women's League. I can't remember how I did that. There was no compulsion, but they did their best to drum up membership. I didn't want to join a mass movement. I've always rejected that. But after Hitler came to power, all the rules and restrictions got going, and a lot of things changed very quickly. Suddenly, there were a lot of regulations, including emergency regulations. But there was also a lot that was positive. They started building the Autobahn. That was a huge change, and it kept people off the street, because among those beggars and poor people, there were a lot who were hanging around out of real poverty, not because they enjoyed bumming around and idling. They were unemployed and had too little support for their families, most of which were growing. Wherever there were poor people, they had fewer children than the rich people did, overcoming the consequences of the First World War that had been imposed on us. Hitler got to grips with that very well at first. At the time, some young people felt that this was a liberation. My brothers could go and sit in a pub in the evening, which they had never done before. They joined the Hitler Youth and were with their peers away from home. They went wherever they felt like. They went on outings, away from their parents. At any rate, there were so many things that were suddenly better, so that you just had to say, my word, this is all fantastic. Then, a little while later, I hadn't quite finished doing Wolf Bleis' book with him, and immediately after the 1933 elections, he was called to the Deutsches Theater as a dramatist. He suggested I came with him, and that was the beginning of my rise. Without the lucky chance of meeting Wolf Bly, my whole life would probably have taken a different course, and I'd have ended up somewhere else as a secretary. And he said to me, "Well, your Jewish boss won't be around much longer. Don't you fancy working for the Broadcasting Corporation? I'll find something to dictate to you." I still remember that he told me that before in about Christmas 1932. "So, these National Socialists, another election, and they'll have done it." And if they'd done it, he would be sorted out for the rest of his life. And that was what happened. He had belonged to the party even before. Not even the clever Nazis knew that a completely fake, completely unartistic person was being given a job in the Deutsches Theater. But he got the job shortly after Hitler's seizure of power. They were just rehearsing their first big theatrical performance at the time. Wilhelm Tell, with Heinrich George as Gessler and Attila Hörbiger as Tell. I sat around in the theater and had nothing to do at first. Every now and again he would dictate some letters to me. But he valued me so much that he always paid me a slightly bigger salary. I was glad of that, and I enjoyed it, particularly when the secretary, the theater secretary, one Fräulein Blankenstein, allowed me to visit her in her office. On one wall she had portraits of all the actors hanging up with a dedication. One of the greatest things was when I was having a conversation with her and the door opened and who comes in? The actor Attila Hörbiger, who was every girl's heartthrob at the time. He took out a cigarette case and offered me a cigarette, which I smoked trembling. Those were experiences that I regaled the dinner table with in the evening. A few months later, Herr Bly told me he was going to negotiate with the Broadcasting Corporation, and he asked me if I would be interested in taking a job there. He could bring his secretary, but he wanted her to be paid by the Broadcasting Corporation rather than paying her himself. He wanted to get me a contract with the Broadcasting Corporation. "That's great," I thought, "with such a big company. What an opportunity." So I was very happy to say yes. A short time later, he said to me,
"It looks like it's working. It looks like it's working. With you too. I think we can bank on it."
We were still going to the Deutsches Theater, where he still had the job as dramatist. Then, he said a little while later,
"You are in the party, aren't you?"
"No," I said, "I'm not in the party."
He said, "It would be a good idea to join for a company like this."
"Well," I said, "then I'll join."
"Yes," he said. "I don't know if it's open for membership at the moment."
At that point, the party was the party, and the whole world wanted to be a member, because everyone assumed that this would be the big man who was going to be on the side of the little people. This had been their message before, so it was a good idea to belong to the party. And I thought I'd join too, so he said it meant I could work for the Broadcasting Corporation. Then I told them at home, "I'm going to join the party for this or that reason."
Well, my parents didn't care either way. "Do what you like."
And that same afternoon, my Jewish friend Eva Löwenthal paid me a visit, and we were going for coffee. That actually meant taking Eva out for coffee, because we all knew she had no money. If you said, "Let's go for a coffee," it meant, "I'm taking you out for coffee." So I said, "Eva, we can't today. I have to join the party very quickly," because the party always opened up, let a few hundred or thousand people in, and then closed again. They couldn't keep up with making the membership cards, so people had to queue up again until it was their turn with the next recruitment drive. "Yes," Eva said, "I'll come with you." Eva and I went together to the local group in Südende. There was an NSDAP there, and at least 100 people were standing outside. They all wanted to join the party, because they thought it would be closed again on the first of the month, and it was a good idea to be in. I had to join the queue. While she waited, Eva sat on a wall, and it all happened very quickly. It was very well organized. You went in, and you had to sign something. The monthly fee was supposed to be 2 marks. That was painful. That was a very big sum. But even more painful was the fact that I had to pay a 10-mark joining fee. That was harsh. That was my whole kitty. It meant going for coffee was out of the question. 10 marks was a lot of money at the time. But I signed anyway, because I thought that if things worked out with the Broadcasting Corporation, I'd forget the 10 marks very soon. And things did work out, so I joined the party. Later, if anyone asked me, "Are you in the party?" I said, "Yes, I'm in the party." But otherwise, no one actually asked me. And later, when I was working in the Ministry of Propaganda, no one asked me at all. I don't even know if they were all in the party. So that was an overhasty move on my part, but it didn't do me any harm either. Then, after a few weeks, I got a letter from the local group and a proper membership card, member of the NSDAP since such and such a date. Then I got another letter because they said at the time, as a member of the party, you had to do something for the party. You had to take part in street collections, and they had a few suggestions. Then I thought, let's wait for a while. There were street collections all the time. The tins were always rattling for all kinds of things. I didn't yet feel that I was affected. But then I got a letter telling me to report to the local group. So I went along, and they made it quite clear to me that I was now a member of the party, and I hadn't yet done anything for the party. "Right. What am I supposed to do?" I asked.
"What do you do for a living?"
"I work for the Broadcasting Corporation."
"Right," they said. Then I could write for them in the party office. At 6 in the evening, when the shops were just closed, they had a bit of mail to sort out and needed someone to write. So I no longer had an excuse and had to type out pointless things. Then I phoned them and came up with some excuses.
"I can't come. We've got a program this evening and I have to be there." They believed me. The next week I had a different excuse, until in the end they said they were no longer interested in me working for them since they couldn't rely on me. After that they finally left me in peace. But they kept asking me to do street collections for orphans and the poor, which I thought was awful. I remember one of the collections particularly clearly. It was a very big collection day in winter. The chocolate firm Zarotti, the one with the little Zarotti Moor, a sweet little dwarf in a striped uniform with a black face, supported the collection. Zarotti chocolate was the best chocolate there was at the time. The company made the uniform available to the Broadcasting Corporation. Someone had said it would be a good thing if the collector showed a bit of imagination and dressed themselves up as fairy tale characters, and this was in the middle of winter. And then the uniform came to our department and everyone said, "Pomseline, you put it on!" And it was the right size for me. It was really made for a small person like me. Out of fabulous fabric. All silk. An expensive, delightful uniform. Great astonishment on the part of the others as they said, "You've got to go with your collecting tin to the winter relief collection dressed as the Zarotti Moor." And that was what happened. All the famous actors were around collecting, and people flocked there just to see the actors and the politicians and a little Zarotti as well. I was assigned to the finance minister of the time. He gave a speech, and I swung the tin and danced around him. And of course, I had a huge audience. It was all on Unter den Linden, and it also spread to the Tierpark and the Tiergarten. But the main part of it was, of course, in front of the Stadtschloss and the Reichstag. And I danced around until it was dark, until the collecting was all over, and we'd handed over our money, and then we could go home. I remember my mother putting me in the bathtub and trying to get all the brown makeup off me. Meanwhile, Herr Bley had taken up his new job in the Broadcasting Corporation as head of the board of directors, and I got a lovely room of my own with another office next to it. It was full of offices, that beautiful, elegant building. It was a sensation at the time because the building was very modern with its clinker bricks and its shape. At first, I didn't have much to do. There was a lovely canteen in the building. The other ladies invited me for dinner. There was a wonderful roof garden upstairs where dinner was served by the canteen staff as well. Working there, I met a few girls with whom I would be friends for a long time, until they all died. Some friendships from my time at the Broadcasting Corporation ran through my whole life. One of them is even still alive. She's a year older than me. Anyway, as quickly as he jumped into that job, Wolf Bley was gone. By the end of the year, he had said goodbye, I think by Christmas, and then he had left. They couldn't do anything with him at the Broadcasting Corporation. He couldn't do anything. He just washed up on the tide. He had been a young soldier, a young pilot, and then he cheated his way through life, but never did any training or studying. But of course, he joined the party early. I never heard of him again afterwards. He was just one of the old fighters that the Nazis had promised to look after once they were in power. They wanted to put him somewhere or other. But like many others, he wasn't what you would call a genius. At any rate, I stayed at the Broadcasting Corporation. It was thanks to that lucky encounter with Wolf Bly that I had a contract, and a very nice contract, too. Oh, I can't remember how much exactly, but anyway, I was making over 200.